Moto Casino, American Social Casino.
Welcome to Moto Casino, where the excitement never ends, with thousands of the hottest free-to-play social casino games, fastest payouts, and the best promotions in the industry. No tricks or gimmicks. Owned and operated in the USA.
Moto Casino is a free-to-play social casino. No purchase necessary. 21 plus to play. Void where prohibited.
Sign up today for a generous welcome bonus.
Moto Casino, American Social Casino.
Download the Moto Casino app today.
Centerpiece of the entire web is the use of children for sex.
It was a stunning case that ultimately revealed the secretly perverse lifestyle Wesson had forced his family to lead.
It was more like an organized crime family.
According to Yahweh's law, that was just the way it was supposed to be.
One verse that said if you don't like him, kill him. I really wish I could find him.
Welcome back to another episode of Seven Deadly Sinners. Thank you guys for listening, and man, I've been getting amazing case ideas from you all for next season. And even if I don't think it could be an episode, I just recently received one that was just a follow-up to an episode that I've now dug deeper on, and it's so much bigger than I thought it was and was covered up in mainstream media, so I mean, now it might be an episode, so please keep reaching out. Tell me your stories. Because sometimes these local cases you all know best, and they're the most underserved and in need of recognition. Especially when they're unsolved, because all these victims deserve justice. And it's important when you guys have like a local sort of affinity to it, or maybe even a personal story with it. All right, now for the crime. We are nearing the end of this series. And what I'm wrapping up in these next few episodes is truly what possessed me to focus on this series so much. And I'm not alone on being obsessed with this. I was listening to My Favorite Murder this past week, and Georgia was talking about reading the Snow Killings about the Oakland County child killings and the crazy connections to many rings during that time. And Georgia feels the same way I do. Pedophile rings in the 70s and 80s were going crazy. Those were her words, not mine, but I gotta agree. These motherfuckers were organized, too. And some of the most famous cases of missing children, like Johnny Gosch, were victims of these scumbags, most likely. And now for the details of Johnny Gosch's kidnapping. You see, Johnny lived in a nice, quiet neighborhood with his mom, Noreen Gosch, and his father, John Gosch Sr., and his two half-siblings who were, like, over 5 years older than him. Because Noreen had lost her first husband to cancer, with whom Johnny's half-siblings were conceived. She remarried to John Gosch Sr., and her new husband added little Johnny to their blended family. By all accounts, life was pretty normal. A family trying to make good in the 70s and early 80s. And Johnny is described as a very sweet kid. He also had a big sense of humor, and was a little go-getter. You see, he really wanted a dirt bike to go riding with his older brother. And so he got a job as a paper boy and saved up to buy his prized dirt bike. Paper routes for little kids were common back in the day. Actually, I'm pretty sure my dad did one and many of his friends, but I don't think it's that common today. I mean, in my generation, I don't think my mom even let my sister and I walk to a friend's house in the neighborhood. Oh, actually, when I think about it, she did let us walk to the park once. My sister's older than me. I was maybe five, I was like, eight? Who knows? We were kids, but the park was across the street. And Talia had to ruin it for all of us and picked up a hypodermic needle and brought it back to my mom from the park. And we were never allowed to walk anywhere again. So, different generation. Also, paranoid mom. But there was that needle, so I kind of get it. Anyways, jokes aside, still dark, guys. What's going to happen? I got to lighten the mood. Okay. So it was a different time, though, when Johnny went missing. But it wasn't just a different time in the sense of, like, people let their kids, you know, go to the store, do whatever. Johnny's case was specifically strange. So many weird things happened leading up to Johnny's kidnapping. And whether they're related or not, they are worth noting for what happens later. It's going to seem like I'm going to go heavy into the dad right now. I truly don't have a solid opinion formed, and I may never be able to have one, because I'd like to believe he was not at all involved, and that if you look at certain things under a misguided microscope of grief or desperation, you might hone on things more than you normally would. But then again, that could be a good thing. But as of now, my opinion is just that his behavior was a tad strange. Again, there's no concrete evidence saying he was involved in Johnny's abduction in any way, but there is presented evidence that links him to members of this ring, and also withheld information from his wife, at the time, Noreen, that is just really strange. So apparently after John Gosch Sr. took Johnny on a day trip to Omaha, Nebraska for business, weird hang-up phone calls plagued their Iowa home after that point. According to Noreen Gosch, hang-up phone calls in the middle of the night, right after that trip, became a regular occurrence. These went on for weeks. They would answer, say, wrong number, and just hang up. But Noreen said the night before Johnny's disappearance, they got another one of those calls. And John Sr. answered and actually had a very short yes and no type conversation with the caller. Noreen questioned him about it, and he said it was just wrong number again. She was like, why would you stay on the phone for a minute or so if it was just a wrong number? Eventually, they just dropped the matter. It was brushed under the rug, and the couple went to bed. Also, side note, those hang-up calls stopped after Johnny went missing. And one other weird thing, a few months prior to his disappearance, the family was attending Johnny's older brother's football game, and Johnny had asked to go to the concession stand by himself to get some snacks, and the parents agreed and said that they would keep an eye on him, and he was only allowed to go to the concession stand and back. But after Johnny hadn't returned in a timely manner, John Sr. went to go look for him, and he found him under the bleachers talking to a man in a police uniform. Whether he was a real cop or not, we will never know, but to pull a kid away under the bleachers for a secret chat is beyond sketchy to me. After that encounter, Johnny told his mom and dad he wanted to be a cop when he grew up. Okay. Now cut to the morning of the abduction. So this was just mere hours after they received that final late night phone call that John Sr. briefly corresponded to the caller on. Johnny woke around 5 a.m., gathered his red wagon to hitch to his bike to carry the newspapers, he brought his dog, and he set out on his own that morning. He didn't awake his dad or mom to join him on this Sunday morning paper route, something they claimed had never happened before. And then the morning went like this. It's Sunday, September 5th, 1982. A neighbor who knew the Gosch family and who allowed Johnny to cut through his yard to get to his route heard Johnny that morning just like he always had, routinely. He would cut through his yard to make it quicker every morning and business as usual. But then things got scary. Witnesses, including another neighbor named John Rossi, a few other paper boys, and a young boy who was awoken by the sound of a door slamming from his second story window, looked out the window and witnessed much of what happened next. He told his dad what he saw, and we'll hear from his dad in a few moments. From most witness accounts, it seems that Johnny was almost targeted. First, the man pulled up in a blue Ford Fairmont and started talking directly to Johnny while the other paper boys were sorting their papers. The man asked Johnny for directions to a location 20 plus blocks away, and Johnny did his best to help, but eventually called an adult neighbor over to talk to the adult male. But once the neighbor was talking to the man, Johnny turned to the other paper boys and was like, "That guy was weird." And the other boys agreed. The man eventually drove away, but not before he flicked his dome lights in his car off and on 3 times. Then flipped a Huey and turned left. Noreen Ghosh says she believes the driver was signaling another co-conspirator to kidnap Johnny. And she's probably right, because moments later, after Johnny had turned to his fellow paperboys and said that that man was weird, Johnny went on his way, and within eyeshot of the paperboys and the neighbor witnesses, a second man emerged out from between two houses and followed Johnny. In the Who Took Johnny documentary, neighbor and witness John Rossi states this.
I was there that morning. Johnny was doing his wagon. Johnny's dog was there with him. There were two or three other carriers there doing the same. I was the only adult, though. There happened to be a car on 42nd Street, and there was a guy in there, and he was talking to Johnny Ghosh. And Johnny said, hey, can you come over here and help this guy? And then all of a sudden, this car just swung. He made a U-turn, took off. I thought it was kind of strange that he would do that.
I think I told the police he looked like he was mad about something.
He wasn't drunk, but he looked like he's been drinking a lot of caffeine, you know, that kind of thing. Not sleepy. Well, he wasn't sleepy. He was, looked like he was on, you know, ready to go. That's kind of odd at 6 o'clock in the morning.
Then one of the paper boys named Mike corroborated this. Mike was loading up his papers, and he stated that he saw a car drive up just past where Johnny was pulling his wagon, east on the north side of Ashworth Road. Mike says he saw a car then stop and back up to the point where Johnny was walking, and it appeared that Johnny spoke briefly to him. I will post a screen grab of the sketch of this and the reenactment from the documentary because it explains so much. It's fascinating. Mike then saw another man walking and step off the curb where Johnny was walking and follow him into the street. And then another witness, PJ Smith, who was a kid sleeping in a house right where it happened, on the second story of his house, heard a car door slam, then sits up in bed, sees another Ford Fairmont that was black and silver, start up his engine, and then U-turn and pull off fast, rolling through a stop sign. The two other newspaper boys then reported that they walked back to where Johnny had been. Johnny's red wagon was the only trace left of him. He was gone, vanished almost into thin air. PJ Smith's father in the documentary then states this.
You know, the trail gets cold real quick. And they just thought, like all cops do, it's a runaway. A kid ran away. Now, this kid didn't run away. Johnny was our paper boy. Knew him, knew his parents, been out to dinner with him. Johnny would not run away.
The Ghosh parents then get a call. A regular customer and family friend alerts them that Johnny, who's usually punctual and responsible, never dropped off his paper. John Ghosh Sr. then hits the streets and claims he found Johnny's red wagon, but no Johnny. In another odd move by John Ghosh Sr., instead of just going straight into finding his son, he delivers the rest of Johnny's papers. Meanwhile, Noreen is calling the police. It took them 45 minutes to show up, even though they were stationed just 10 blocks away. And they were as useless 45 minutes upon arrival as they were when they hadn't even known about the abduction. They simply stated that he probably ran away and asked the parents if he'd done this before. He had not.
Moro Casino, America's social casino.
Welcome to Moto Casino, where the excitement never ends. With thousands of the hottest free-to-play social casino games, fastest payouts, and the best promotions in the industry. No tricks or gimmicks. Owned and operated in the USA.
Moto Casino is a free-to-play social casino. No purchase necessary. 21 plus to play. Void where prohibited.
Sign up today for a generous welcome bonus.
Moto Casino, America's social casino.
Download the Moto Casino app today.
Cleveland is where the urban meets the outdoors, where cultural celebrations meet rabid sports fans meet the symphony, where nobody goes hungry and everybody loves music. Fueled by passion, we are the land for life. From rich history to hidden gems, the Legends of the Land podcast shares the real stories from real Clevelanders that shape the city. From iconic chefs to grassroots changemakers, sports heroes to creative visionaries, learn why living all out is in Cleveland's DNA. Go to thisiscle.com/podcast.
Fall is busy. You know, kids are going back to school, and we're starting to look forward to the holidays. And in Greg's and my case, we are planning a wedding. So we need easy, stress-free options to nourish our bodies and keep us going. And that's why I am, hands down, a devotee of HelloFresh. Because with HelloFresh, you save time you'd otherwise spend meal planning, shopping, chopping, all that stuff. And so now you can get back to what really matters. HelloFresh's family-friendly menu is a big win for back-to-school season with easy, delicious recipes for drama-free dinners. HelloFresh offers 50 menu and market items to choose from every week, from vegetarian meals and calorie-smart choices, I'm going to need them while I'm trying to fit into a wedding dress, to extra special gourmet options. There's something for everyone to enjoy. With recipes designed and tested by professional chefs and nutritional experts to ensure deliciousness and simplicity. And you get better value with HelloFresh. It's over 30% cheaper than shopping at grocery stores, with pre-portioned ingredients that ensure you won't spend money on excess food that ends up going in the trash. That's super important to me because I hate wasting food. So try HelloFresh yourself. It's going to make your life so much easier, healthier, convenient, all the things. So go to HelloFresh.com/Sinners14 and use code Sinners14 for up to 14 free meals, including free shipping. Go to HelloFresh.com/Sinners14 and use code Sinners14 for up to 14 free meals, including free shipping. And that's why HelloFresh is America's number one meal kit. The eyewitnesses even spoke up, all corroborating similar accounts. Johnny was taken by two men. Johnny was taken. But police just kept insisting he ran away. But why? The West Des Moines Police Department were extremely skeptical from the get-go. They started treating a shell-shocked mother and father like suspects. They filed a one-page police report with only one seemingly sarcastic note. Quote, "Mother says this is not at all like her son. Was supposed to deliver papers this morning. Wagon and papers still at pick place." End quote. The police even refused to take the photos of Johnny Noreen gave them in order to identify Johnny. They just straight up refused. They said, "We don't need these." How in the world is this good police work? Even if you think he just ran away, I mean, at the very least, you take the photos offered from the parents. Even if you plan to let the case file rot on a shelf in the back of the precinct, the act of refusing to take photos of the missing child appears to be a deliberate avoidance of collecting evidence or data that could be helpful for solving the case. As if from the onset, they had predetermined finding Johnny was of little importance. And what gets me is a potential Freudian slip on the police report, which we obtained online and I'll post in the source notes. Remember, they suspect Johnny to be a runaway, okay? And not kidnapped. Well, then what did they mean by, quote, "wagon and papers still at pick place"? To me, it sounds like pickup place, like they were acknowledging he was picked up and abducted. Or it was a picked location? Strange, not sure what to make of it, but I don't think pick place is police lingo. But I'm not a cop, so I don't know. The local police were completely idle and indifferent, and in some cases actively sabotaging efforts to investigate the disappearance of Johnny Gosch. And it just keeps getting more bizarre. You see, the police chief at the time was a raging alcoholic. Sorry, I'm not going to use the PC terms for substance misuse disorder for this bastard right now. they'll use it for other people. He not only refused to search for or allow his subordinates to search for Johnny, but Sheriff Orville Cooney showed up to a community organized search rally, shit-faced, and stood on the hood of a car with a megaphone and shouted, "Just go home. This kid is nothing but a damn runaway." Listen, besides him being a whiskey-soaked asshole, it was also the general consensus at the time that boys didn't matter. Boys run away. Boys will be boys. People had no frame of reference that boys were being kidnapped, or they simply couldn't stomach hearing it. Well, thank God, men like Ken wouldn't exist. When all of their resources were exhausted and no one of authority would listen to them, Ken Wooden had seen Noreen pleading for her son to matter on the news. He reached out to her. Ken, who was a resident at Iowa State University at the time, and who Noreen described in the Who Took Johnny documentary as a pedophilia expert, and who is now referred to as a child safety expert and child advocate, and is highly regarded in his field. Ken told Noreen he knew right away when he heard that Johnny went missing and his dog was left on the scene. It was obvious. If the dog was still there, no kid is just going to run away and leave their dog. It was obvious something sinister had happened. Here's Ken in the documentary.
One of our big breaks in the case was the fact that a man by the name of Ken Wooden called me. And he was an expert on pedophilia.
I was in residence at Iowa State University, and an article came out in the paper. A newspaper boy, serving papers, missing, and his dog was still there. And it was obvious. If the dog was still there, he was no runaway.
I had never heard the word pedophile.
Noreen Gosh had already believed her son was kidnapped. But Ken's expertise helped solidify that. And that, coupled with years of clues, tips, phenomenal happenings where Johnny would reappear and leave a trail of breadcrumbs, cannot be ignored. 2 years later, in June of 1984, a nearly catatonic Noreen Gosh gets a phone call from a self-proclaimed, quote, local man, claiming to have valuable information on Johnny. According to Noreen's sworn testimony, this was a man named Sam Soda, calling her to arrange a meeting, acting as a private investigator. They met at Soda's office on June 13, 1984. Noreen brought a tape recorder and recorded as Soda revealed that an informant tipped him off that there would be a second kidnapping in Des Moines very soon. Soda specified that it would occur on the south side of Des Moines. The victim would be another paperboy, and it would take place on the second weekend in August. Noreen thanked him for the information, but was puzzled by why he didn't go to the police. Then, just as Soda predicted, the second weekend in August 1984, 13-year-old Eugene Martin disappears while delivering the Des Moines Register newspaper on his regular paper route. Sam Soda would seem like a prime suspect to me. Perhaps he's a sociopath with an inflated ego, narcissistic enough to try and play with the family's emotions and meddle in the case. But of course, Noreen and her recording of the second paperboy abduction prophecy were dismissed by every long arm of the law she approached. So she had the Des Moines Register reporter Frank Santiago listen to the tapes. Witnesses said they saw Martin talking to a clean-cut white male in his 30s, sometime between 5 and 5:45 a.m. at Southwest 12th Street and Highview Drive. Some stated the two appeared to be engaged in friendly, quote, father-son sort of conversation, and others recalled seeing the teen folding papers and talking to the man sometime between 5:45 and 6:05 a.m. The following month, Sam Soda exposes a pedophile working at the Des Moines Register named Frank Sikora. Not for anything related to the Gosh case, almost as if to throw the scent off of him. Then, in June of 1985, a dollar bill in Sioux City, Iowa, pops up with a message. Quote, "I am alive, and it was signed with Johnny Gosch's signature. Three separate handwriting experts confirmed the signature to be Johnny's. It was impossible to know when and where the dollar had been signed and sent into circulation, but it was a ray of hope and proof that he was alive and being held against his will somewhere relatively close to Sioux City. Later, Noreen and several other Des Moines residents were mailed an altered poster containing the sketch she had previously paid to have made based on witness descriptions of the man from the Blue Ford Fairmont. This sketch bears an uncanny resemblance to Sam Soda. And to further that assertion, a newspaper photograph of Sam Soda was included on the poster with an arrow drawn from the sketches to the newspaper clipping. This collage, pointing to Sam Soda as a suspect, was anonymously sent to multiple people in Des Moines, and when the cops started to look at him as a person of interest, the Gosches suddenly started to be harassed and threatened at their home. After a barrage of threats, cold leads, and dead-end ransoms, Noreen held a press conference to allude to the public that they had three suspects from Des Moines that the cops were looking into, which may have only been an attempt to trick the harassers into fleeing. And it worked. Not surprising at all, Sam Soda fled Des Moines after the press conference. And something tells me that Sam Soda is not innocent. But still, the cops did nothing. They don't send federal agents after him with jurisdiction across state lines. No, they instead enjoy the peace that the Gosches are now no longer being harassed and that they might hear from Noreen a little less. Johnny Gosch was later seen by a woman in Oklahoma City in a parking lot when he ran away from two men and ran up to her and exclaimed, "I'm Johnny Gosch, please help me," before being carted off by the two disgruntled men. And when the woman reports it to the police, she is literally told it was probably some kid making it up, was mad at his parents, and that it sounds like a family matter. What? I mean, at the very least, isn't that worth reporting to his mother, Noreen? Nope. They brush it under the desk until the woman saw a picture of Johnny Gosch on TV, that same woman, and called the OKC police back and confirmed that was the boy she saw. They went ahead and let the family know then, you know, weeks after the event, when any suspect could be thousands of miles away and any clue is long gone. Then, another kidnapping occurred in 1986. It was March 29th, and Mark Allen vanished from his suburban Des Moines neighborhood. The last thing he said to his mom was, "Save me some pizza, Mom. I'll be hungry when I get home." And poof, he was gone and never seen again. Law enforcement at least got busy on these later abductions. However, the practices for tracking down an armed robbery suspect didn't apply to this pedophile ring. These men were more calculated and better connected than your typical petty thief. They focused way more on armed robbery, not really any other crime, other than crimes against children. And then on Valentine's Day, 1988, Noreen Gosch got a typed letter in the mail, signed, "Your son, Johnny Gosch," which was a hallmark of Johnny's to sign off with, quote, "your son." It gave credence to the letter's validity. He also said in the letter, quote, "I'll never be permitted to return home. They've cut my hair. They've dyed my hair. Please never forget me." This is so heart-wrenching. And the reason why Noreen is so certain that was Johnny writing that letter is that as a kid, he used to write his mom and dad, siblings, letters, and he would always write "your son" or "your brother, Johnny Gosch." And they would kind of tease him like, "We know you're our son." It's just a very specific detail that she knows in her heart could only be Johnny. And then, what sealed the deal in all of this, one that no one expected, happened next. 1989, Paul Benassi blew this case wide open when he came forward about the local human sex trafficking cartel ran by Larry King. John DeCamp, his lawyer, read a transcript from a session between Paul and his psychiatrist, where Paul mentioned an abduction in Iowa, and the dates matched up with Johnny's disappearance. Mr. Gosch, without his wife's knowledge, went to visit Paul in prison, where Paul told him his eyes looked just like Johnny Gosch's. This prompted Mr. Gosch to hire a private investigator named Roy Stevens. Roy interviewed Paul on tape for hours, where he disclosed that a man named Emilio ran a kidnapping business selling children, purposely targeting children from close families to inflict the most pain. Paul recounted staying in a hotel with Emilio and waking up early when the paper boys were due, riding in his blue Ford Fairmont. After a man named Tony nabbed Johnny, it was Paul's job to hold him down and keep him quiet in the back seat. Paul was later forced at gunpoint by Emilio to molest Johnny Gosch on tape. Roy Stevens found two other people that stated Paul was involved in Johnny's kidnapping. And despite Congressman John DeCamp also believing his client was telling the truth, the FBI did not investigate Paul Benanzi's claims. The local Des Moines police, to no surprise to anyone at this point, also did not interview Paul Benanzi or even consider this a lead in the case. And they almost do so proudly. Here's a clip of them talking in the documentary.
You've got a case that's been unsolved for 10 years. I would think you'd be kicking the doors down to want to talk to him at this point.
Well, the time is right. Again, I will reiterate, we may well interview Paul Benanzi, but it will be when we're ready to do it.
How much more time has to go by?
I have no idea.
So they just ignored him, even though Paul connected this whole ring back to Omaha, Washington, D.C. Named names, faces, details. He would only know had he been there. And his biggest bombshell yet was Colorado, where he claims Johnny Gosch was held captive. And this is where we'll end this episode, because you're about ready to be mind blown and dumped with a ton of information of how super predators like John David Norman are connected in every hot spot where these abductions and rings operated out of, and even perhaps lived in the house in Colorado where Johnny Gosch was held captive. I know this is a very tangled web, and it can be difficult to piece together with the people, places, and clues spread out across the American Great Plains like needles in a haystack, but I promise you, it matters. And we're getting somewhere. Like I said, next week, I'm going to that ranch, that place where Johnny was potentially held captive. And not to sound like a crazy person, there might be a cult compound nearby with underground tunnels that I may have to look into as well. It'll all make sense next week. All right, guys, thank you so much for listening, and I love you. If you enjoy the show, the best thing you can do is to tell a friend. Leave a 5-star rating and positive review on Apple Podcasts or wherever you like to listen. Thank you, guys. Bye.
Moro Casino, America's social casino.
Welcome to Moto Casino, where the excitement never ends. With thousands of the hottest free-to-play social casino games, fastest payouts, and the best promotions in the industry. No tricks or gimmicks. Owned and operated in the USA.
Moto Casino is a free-to-play social casino. No purchase necessary. 21 plus to play. Void where prohibited.
Sign up today for a generous welcome bonus.
Moto Casino, social casino.
Download the Moto Casino app today.
Cleveland is where the urban meets the outdoors, where cultural celebrations meet rabid sports fans meet the symphony, where nobody goes hungry and everybody loves music. Fueled by passion, we are the land for life. From rich history to hidden gems, the Legends of the Land podcast shares the real stories from real Clevelanders that shaped the city. From iconic chefs to grassroots changemakers, sports heroes to creative visionaries, learn why living all out is in Cleveland's DNA. Go to thisisCLE.com/podcast.